the bottom of the popularity as far as the AA steps go. Going to deal first with 8, which because of its association with 9, has got to be on our least popular steps. And maybe I can shock you right at the start in talking about 8 by telling you that of the 12 steps, the one that has made the greatest single contribution to helping me live more healthily is the 8th step, the step we're dealing with right now. Basically, what it did was help me become aware of you and your feelings. I hurt that badly, if you remember the sharing that I did when I came into this program. I've hurt that badly my entire life. That in the pain that I had on my island, I couldn't take the time to stop and become aware of you as a person and the feelings that you had. Steps 1 through 7 and the principles connected with those steps, the terror, the confidence, the relief, the self-awareness, the openness, the wholeness, and the cooperating with God, the cooperation, bring me to a state where there's enough minimal peace in my life that I can pause now and listen to you and become aware of you as a person. To put this in terms of the parable of the walking on the water, when I'm drowning, it's impossible for me to become aware of you in the same sea, whether you're swimming or drowning, unless somehow I can use you almost at some time of flux that I can use to try to stay afloat. And that's all I used people for. By the 7th step, I feel some security on top of the water. And at this particular point, I'm able to look down and notice so many people in pain in my world, so many people swimming desperately, so many people drowning in their own way. And I can become aware of them. The principle of the 4th step was self-awareness, and I phrased it in that rather awkward way to balance the 8th step, which for me has as its principle other awareness. I can become aware of you as a person. And only when I become aware of you and where you're at do I feel, as I've shared several times in passing, that I really become qualified to sponsor. I used to say that I felt a person could sponsor after they've done their own 4th and 5th steps. As I've shared, I've amended that now, and I really feel that only when a person has made their list do they reach a point where they really become capable of becoming aware of other people, their feelings, and their needs. And at that particular point, they can sponsor healthily. You see, early in my sobriety, I've done a lot of damage trying to help people. I had a friend who came to me one afternoon when I had just finished making a big leap forward spiritually. And I shared it with her, completely forgetting so much that she had shared with me. And she, her self-confidence was so delicate that she knew she couldn't do this. And to her, that said she was a failure and she was going to get drunk and she fell apart as a person, completely collapsed. And I knew enough about her to know that that should have happened. If I just took the time that day to remember where she was, and to relate with her and to be gentle in what I shared. And it took me 3 hours of gentle affirming to bring her back to where she was before I opened my mouth. And I wish I could say I've never done that before, but maybe if I learned from my past mistakes, I couldn't be an alcoholic. Because I've done that since, and I've done it in the past year. Forget where people are at and ask them to make a step too big for them. The only step you can take is the first step from where you're at. Not the first step for me. Not the first step that I want you to take. The only comfortable step you can take is the first step from where you're at. And if I'm going to be effective in sharing with you, I have to listen. I have to hear where you're at. Because if I ask you to take a step that's too far, I'm going to have you produce a spiritual hernia and strain yourself in unhealthy ways. And so it's very important for me to know where you're at. The 8th step made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all, has 2 parts. And the man who illuminated this step for me and took away most of the pain died last year, Bob White, Whitney, Texas. He died just about 9 months sober of 30 years sober. And I couldn't have the time to tell you all that I gained from him in private conversations about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. What he shared with me is there's two parts. And he felt these steps came from God, and I do too. And he said God could have told me and us, became willing to make amends to all persons we had harmed, therefore made a list. And if the step was written like that, I'd have to be willing when I made the list. But it isn't like that. It says made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends. And what he told me was crucial and took most of the pain out of the eighth step, as I've told you. He said, when I made my list, I didn't have to be willing then and in my mind ever to make amends to any of those people. And that made the list easy to do, and it made the list very helpful in my own life. When I made my list, I was unwilling to make amends to 90% of the names on my list. When I made my list, I was happy I did the things I did to 50% of the names on the list. There's one more. When I made my list, I wish 10% of those people were there so I could do it again. I remember writing something and smiling that I did this to that, you know, Clancy's term is that crap head. That isn't my word. My word is more asshole. I mean, it's a little grosser, but, you know, I remember writing about somebody and wishing that asshole was there so I could do it again and wishing he was there so he could see how I could enjoy what I did to him. And that had nothing to do with the spirit of the first half of the eighth step. Afterwards, I began praying to become willing. I want to talk about this. We make a list of all persons we had harmed. I'm now going to share something that I've held in for about five steps. And I've got ready to talk about it before, and I remembered that it's in the eighth step for some reason that I normally do this. One of the strangest quirks about Alcoholics Anonymous is, as a fellowship almost, we will die for your right to have God as you understand him in the third step, and we take it away in the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, and tenth steps. I tell you, you can have whatever experience of God you want, and then we put a list of defects on our clubhouse walls and assets. And I think if you pause a moment and you think at all, your understanding of God will determine what is right or wrong. There's a sect in India whose God demands strangulation murders as a way to honor her. If you belong to that sect, strangulation murder is an asset, not a liability, and not murdering is a defect of character. Hope none of you belong to it. I think you usually do it from behind, though, so I'm safe while I'm facing you. But this is real important. I can't tell you what was wrong in your life. I can't tell you what the errors are that you've got to inventory, and that's why I tried to reflect that when I shared on the fourth step. And I can't tell you what the real sins in your life are when you share in the fifth step. And I can't tell you what the defects are. I want to take a moment and talk about this. Some of the lists that I've seen list profanity, cussing, as a defect. I don't agree with that at all. You see, for me, what is defective in my life is what harms unnecessarily me or you. And if I use words to harm you, that's a defect, and I've used profanity that way. But I can give you one clear instance, I could give you more, of when profanity became an asset, a tool of love. I knew a person who was a full drug addict, never with prescription drugs. She was society, and all of her drugs were doctor prescribed. She saw her problem. She came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, had a very healthy sobriety, and she was hired by the government during the real hippie days to run a street clinic for walk-in drug users. Now, their vocabulary is almost 50% Anglo-Saxon four-syllable words. And if she wanted to help them, she had to talk their language. And this gal had never really cursed. And she had to practice cursing until she could roll off the best two-syllable word. I mean, two words, you know. And make it sound as natural as anything in order to help people. There's no way you could tell me that profanity for her was a defect. It was something she had learned to try to help specific people. When a group of guys get together, and often a group of gals, profanity is just a vocabulary. It's just, you know, Penn State, we had it. We had it in the public high school I went to. It certainly is used in a lot among the circle of a lot of the rest of my friends. I'm not harming anybody when I talk like that. If I use it in a sermon, and I say, man, would you get that little son of a bitch out of the church? He's crying and disturbing my sermon. I think I might be using vocabulary that would harm someone. And then it would be wrong. I really have a total gutter vocabulary. And the most amazing thing is 15 years as a priest, I have never slipped a cuss in. And I just don't understand it. God has kind of helped me that I've got a double vocabulary. Can talk with drug addicts and use the vocabulary. Can give a sermon and it all comes out kind of eloquent. AA is kind of a blend. It's almost eloquent, but there's a few little slips come in just to tell me I'm still real. My sponsor says it's just a vain little ploy on my part to let you know I'm really part of you, and he doesn't like when I do it at all. So it's real important that we understand our own God and that we respect our own God. And that's going to apply when we reach the eighth step, what harms are. I can't tell you what a harm is, and I'm going to give you several examples of that. But first I'll tell you, I come into a technique. If I can't tell you what a harm is, how can you discover what harm is? And I stumbled onto a technique. And what the technique is, somebody I sponsored asked me right before the meeting, and I said, I'll tell you what to do. You get a sheet of paper and you write out everybody that you feel through your whole life, living or dead, who, if they were alive, you want to ring your doorbell and make amends to you and write what they did. And after I said this, through the meeting, I started thinking about it, and I instantly saw that this is the single best way to come up with a definition of harmed. The first person I thought of was a high school teacher who deliberately snubbed me, and I wanted her to ring my doorbell and make amends. Do you know when I did my eight-step list, I didn't put down anybody's name that I deliberately snubbed? But I should, because I consider that something that needs amends. At that time, I was writing out several hundred letters of people who 10 years before had sent me presents when I was ordained a priest, and I'd never sent them a thank you note, and I thought I owed them amends. At that same meeting, I thought a moment, and have from the teaching in high school, I've been invited to a lot of weddings, and I've given a lot of wedding presents. And strangely, I've never received a single thank you. I think it's rude, but I don't think one of those people owe me amends. Emily Post probably would. But when I saw that, I went home and ripped up all the envelopes. By my understanding of amends, I don't owe amends for that. In one of my groups, there's a guy who has been in countless barroom fights, and he doesn't think he owes amends to a single person he was in a barroom fight with. I have never had a fight with anybody outside my own family. I'm a coward, and I used to be ashamed of it. I'm proud of it now. I see no sense in unnecessarily subjecting myself to hurt. I don't think there's anything macho about that at all. It's sheer stupid to me. I've only backed down from two fights, and I wish I didn't have to do that because that isn't very seemly in American culture. But when clouds of any kind of anger start forming over here, I'm over here right away. So I'm never around when fights break out. I guarantee you, if anybody hits me, I want them to make amends. But I know this guy wouldn't expect anybody that hit him in a fair fight ever to make amends to him. So his definition of harm doesn't include that. So I have the people I sponsor now first make a list of everybody that they want to make amends to them. And I tell them, you now have 85% of your definition of harm. It can't be totally inclusive because you've probably done some things others didn't think of doing to you. But you go through your list, and if anybody has done this to you, and you want them to make amends to you, you think now everybody you did this to, and you write down their names. And that's my not infringing with somebody else's ability to believe in God. We made a list of all persons. It doesn't make any difference if they're living or dead at all. We're not at the amend-making stage. It doesn't make any difference. It doesn't say all persons who harmed us more or who harmed us first. It's all persons whom we had harmed. Whether I did it first, I did it last, I did it in retaliation, I did it in the middle, whether I did less or I did more, I wrote the person's name and if I harmed them. Make a list of all persons we had harmed. I wrote their name, then I wrote what I did, every single thing that I remember doing, and then I wrote why I did it, because this was being done for me, not for them. What I did and why I did it. And when I was through with my list, and mine was rather long, I was astounded. And I got this result that I told you was so impressive for me. And what I discovered is that you have feelings. And I hadn't been dealing with you as people who had feelings. I had been dealing with you as things put in the world to handle my needs. And you didn't like that. You didn't enjoy being treated like this. You didn't appreciate it. And so you didn't respond to me. And it wasn't good for me. And so I had a change. If I wanted your respect and I wanted your friendship, I had to become aware of your feelings. The worst example that I can show you of how I can deal with people in ways like this occurred 10 years sober. I told you earlier today, if you remember, that my worst trait I feel is my efficiency. On a Saturday morning, I was going to go from about like I got up at 5 and I was going to go till about 11 o'clock at night. I had a huge list of things I had to do. And the very first thing was a quick visit that was an imposition, really, to visit a really neat woman who had been slowly dying of cancer. And I tried to visit her 3-4 times a week. And I went running into the home on my way to do a dozen other things. And I asked how Mary was, and her daughter was at the table. She said she died around midnight. I turned around and got ready to just cross that off my list. And I remembered now I was going to be tied up on Tuesday, wouldn't be available. This was on a Saturday morning, so I just looked at the daughter and said, the funeral has to be Monday morning, and turned around and walked out. Got in my car, and it just, as I was driving to the next thing I had to do, it just suddenly hit me. I hadn't even said a word to her in a human way about the death of her mother because of my efficiency. Crossed the name off the list. I was there to help the mother, and I would have spent some time with the mother. Now, I can't deal with people like that in a healthy way and have people in any way appreciate me in my own world. And I went way out of my way later to try to be human to the family. So made a list of all persons I had harmed with great results for me and became willing. Somebody I sponsored told me how to become willing. He used a phrase that just instantly made sense. He said, becoming willing to make amends is to heal the relationship inside yourself. If I owe you amends inside me, I have broken my relationship with you. Either because you also did something to me or just from my guilt. You and I are not one inside my heart. And the way I become willing to make amends is I just picture you and I'll just start saying any prayer I can. And I'll just keep repeating it. Now, if you weren't here when I commented about feelings, this may sound strange to you, but it's very real to me and very understandable. What starts happening when I picture you and start praying for you is I start hating you more. And the hate gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And I know I have no control over my feelings, and I'm taking the right action, and this is healthy. The way I analyze this is it's like the pus getting out of me, and it's got to come out if I'm going to be at peace with you. And I just let those feelings go. Whatever I feel is okay. I just go right on praying. And I continue praying. We're talking about not a day thing. We're talking about like up to 2 weeks. Most of my free time driving around. And then eventually that anger climaxes and it quickly goes after it climaxes. And then there's just the nothingness. I picture you and I don't feel anything. And then eventually I feel what I call a little bit of the love that AA feels for me for you. A little bit of the love that I feel my God feels for me for you. And the relationship is healed. And what I want in my own mind is for me to be a healthy adult in my mind relating with you as a healthy adult, even though in reality both of us may be sick as hell and immature as hell. The relationship is healed. I did this so much with my mother for years it took inside me until I could be an adult son relating with an adult mother. And I then have a healed relationship. And incidentally, to jump ahead in a sense, once it's healed inside me, the actual making amends is very simple. It's just acting out, expressing what is already real inside me, because I am one with you in my own heart. A neat side effect of all this is it helped me see that I am not responsible for all your failures. You can have bad days, and I don't have to carry the guilt. Those of us who have sort of the Al-Anonism, you know, you walk in and you feel depressed, and we're going to feel guilty about it. The classic instance when I saw this was I was home after I made amends to my mother on vacation, and my mother got up feeling down, and she and I were sitting across a breakfast table from each other. And she was depressed, and I had no idea what caused it, except I knew I had nothing to do with it. I felt total guilt, and I felt an urgency inside me to make her feel good. And you know what I did? I did absolutely nothing. I let her hurt, knowing I wasn't responsible for it, and giving her the privilege to feel miserable if she wanted to. And it was not my responsibility to heal her. She could be just as sick as she enjoyed being, and as she needed to be, because of her own sicknesses at that moment. One way I do this with women, and it helped me get freedom here, I just say, well, you know, they could be having their period. They could be bitchy or down or depressed, and I have nothing to cause that. You know, I'm not bringing that on. I got to just say this. This has nothing to do with anything I'm talking about. I would often ask a gal in a fifth step how they would feel when they had their period. And I had this one gal who enjoyed sex exceptionally frequently, and I said, when you have your period, how do you feel? And she said, relieved. I would really be looking to see if there were difficulties in her life at that time. Some of us are sicker than others. Some of us are slower than others, you know. You know, I want to tell you something, and I hope you hear this. The eighth step, I think, is desperately needed in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've attended AA meetings where they talk about Fat John or Old John or Thin John. And I was chairing a meeting when we had two people with the same name. And they talked about Fat, the name isn't John, but they talked about Fat John. And I stopped and I said, you know, that isn't right. We don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to be hurt. And the person said, he's called that all the time. And you see, I knew from those references to my big ears that just because my brother called me big ears all the time didn't take away the pain. It hurt more and more. And then the person said, but he doesn't react. And I also knew that I had to put a smile on because I couldn't allow my brother to know how badly it was hurting me. I believe you can be hurt more in Al-Anon, you can be hurt more in Alcoholics Anonymous than anywhere else in the world. Because if you're like me, when you come to a meeting, you start lowering your defenses because this is where you expect to be accepted. And if I have all my walls up, I can't feel your acceptance. And when I lower my walls as far as I am capable at this moment, I've made myself vulnerable. And if you make some sarcastic comment about the way I look, you have gotten through all my defenses. I'm going to tell you something that the eighth step shouldn't necessarily need to tell you. I honestly want you to know that by the time you have noticed that I'm putting on weight, my belt has given me that information far in advance. And I really don't need your kindness to ratify what my belt is telling me. I want to turn that around. I was about 7 or 8 years sober, and you know, I told you how I felt ugly. The one thing I've always had, I didn't have a car till I was 20-some years old and walked over my whole hometown, and my legs have always been very nicely developed, and I've always felt very comfortable wearing shorts. Now, after 47, 48 years old, there's a little bit of aging occurring there, and it's upsetting me a little bit, but I still have rather good legs. I can go skiing with 20-year-old kids, and they're worn out, they're tired after a few runs, and my legs don't get tired at all because I'll bicycle 10 to 20 miles a day during the summer now for an exercise. I went to an AA meeting, and I was dressed in shorts, and this good friend of mine who heads a treatment center walked up, and we'd been friends for about 5 years. She looked at me, and with a real honesty, she said, Larry, in all the time I've known you, you've never looked sexier. Do you know she made my night? She did more good than the meeting did. And she taught me the value of an honest compliment, and from that day on, I try to look at people and give them an honest compliment. And if I can find one, I won't ever make one up. I can find it if I look hard enough. It'll be in your hair or your ears, your dress, your smile. There's something in everybody at any time. And if I can be so turned on and uplifted when my defenses are down by something positive, the other side of this being torn down by something negative, I know you can also. And if I'm sincere, I know you feel it. And if you're like me, you feel uncomfortable when you get the compliment, but it wears well later on. The other thing I'd like to share along the same lines, I have heard countless speakers at AA meetings use a phrase that I think is deadly. They've said, "At least I've never." And I will tell you that almost every time that phrase has been used, either I or a friend of mine sitting in their audience did what they were so happy, at least they never did. And if you're delighted that at least in your life, at least you never, and I've done it, you're slapping me in the face. And I don't see any need for you to share that if you're going to be aware of our sympathies. I will tell you, with all of the fifth steps I've heard, the hundreds and hundreds, I have never heard an alcoholic or an Al-Anon say a single thing they did that when they put it in the frame of their life, I could look at them and say, if I were you, I wouldn't have done that. I know you've done things that I haven't because you've gone down different roads from me. I've done things that you haven't. I've broken every rule I've had, and I can tell you that if I never did what you did, if I were in your shoes, I would have done it and worse because I have broken every one of my rules countless times. I did what I never dreamed I could have done, and I still find myself doing some of those things. And I hope a sensibility to our fellowship that for me is the result of the eighth step enables me really to feel where you're at. Do you know, if you've turned some tricks? I remember as an exceptionally naive person with the vocabulary being at a Sex as We Don't Understand It meeting at Young People's at Whitney, Texas. And I was sitting between the legs of this gal, and there's a gal sitting between my legs, and the gal that I'm leaning back on starts talking about turning tricks. And I figured, what the hell is she talking about cards at a sex meeting for? This is serious. And then the gal in front of me talking to these people had done a lot of drugs too. She talked about turning tricks, and the one over here was talking about turning tricks, and I finally started putting two and two together. I think one of the neatest moments in my life was the time at an AA meeting when, after I shared very deeply, again at this Young People's, I gave a kiss of real love to a black lesbian, and I meant it, and I accepted her completely. You know, I wouldn't have spit on someone who had been in the prison when I came to this program, and my fourth step told me that when you steal every cent in the poor fund, and it's like $5,000, $3,000 15 years ago, they don't make you citizen of the year for that. That's grand. I mean, that's a felony. And the only difference between me and them is that they had been caught and prosecuted. And when I finally had to cough up to the bishop what I did, the bishops are reluctant to send their priests to jail. So he didn't prosecute me. My sponsor did hard time, and I respect that man. I put him on a pedestal, seeing him as a real person. And I don't have anybody in this fellowship that I will say, at least I never. Because that means when you tell me you did it, I don't want you as my friend. And God, I need you so much, I don't even have the luxury to talk about that. You know, the eighth step gives me the ability to listen to people, to really hear what they're saying. After my eighth step, I've learned about body talk, and I watch how people look, and I watch when they're closed up, and I watch when they turn their eyes away. I remember one of the saddest things I had was somebody who had a deep sexual problem, a guy, come to talk to me. And I'm going to have to step away a moment, and I'll show you how he sat in a chair. This is closed body talk defenses. This is closed body talk defenses, and he was in a fetal position looking away. It broke my heart to see how defensive and how alone and how on the island of his hurt he was, and I couldn't touch him. But I wanted to very badly. And I saw his was extreme, but I've learned to read body talk. I've learned to be sensitive to what people can't tell me. When somebody calls and they tell me they're okay, I want to know what's wrong. Okay generally means, yeah, there's something good, but there's something hurting right now. I can hear people's tone. I can usually tell in the first 10 seconds when somebody that I sponsor calls me where they're at. I can tell by the tone of their voice now. If I'm working the eighth step and working this principle. I certainly have had my failures, as I've shared with you. I've criticized somebody I sponsor publicly. I remember I have this big thing about being punctual, and a gal I sponsored came 10 minutes late to a meeting, and I shouted out at the meeting, "Hey, the meeting start when the big hand's on the 12. And everybody there knew I sponsored her. And that was a put-down. It could be a joke from a friend, and even then I don't know that it's in good taste. But when it's said by her sponsor, it isn't a joke, it's a criticism. And the eighth step made me aware that I don't want to say things like that, and I had to go up to her. Normally, I believe the amends should be as public as the insult, and I did it in a gentle way at a later meeting, but I wouldn't do it too publicly because it would have been to put her down again. But I let her know that I was really wrong doing that. And I've had to let other people I sponsor know that I've been really wrong in not listening to them or not hearing where they're at and not being open to the needs that they themselves have had. And that's one of the great, great benefits of the eighth step. Moving on to the ninth step. This is a step, made amends, direct amends to all people we had harmed, except when to do so would injure them or others. I must tell you that I haven't fully worked my step. I haven't worked nearly as many names on it as I should have. Therefore, I'm going to be a little bit different in the sharing here. I'm going to talk about three areas. I'm going to say a few things, few general bits of advice on making amends, some advice on the nine step and its principles. We're here. And a final area I'm going to comment on then will be making amends to myself. The parable here is very simple. When I become aware that you're down there drowning, and I'm aware that there's an obstacle in the water that keeps me from reaching my hand out to you that I've put there, I certainly want to do whatever I can to remove that obstacle. If I'm watching you drown and I'm aware of your feelings and I'm grateful and I'm walking through all these principles, and I'm really so surprised that I'm on top of the water and I'm standing there as a whole person, and I'm aware of myself and I'm open to you and I'm aware of you, I really want to heal any obstacle I have put between you and me. And that's my principle also for this step. Basically, the parable is I just reach out and remove anything from the water that I've put that will keep me from helping you. And the principle basically is healing a broken relationship. As I told you, the action began in eight. It's expressed in the eighth step, I heal that relationship within me. But this is still incomplete somehow or other, because if I healed the relationship with you and you don't know it, and I really have healed that relationship, I get a little bit eager to express it. I want to take what's inside me and bring it back out into the world, and so I deal with the healing. You know, healing and unity really come from within me. If I swallow you within me, there's nothing you can do about it. If I remove the obstacles and put you or a group inside myself, we're one. And there's really nothing you can do to break that unity. You can refuse to acknowledge it. You can refuse to accept it. But you and I are one in my heart, and we can just stay there. And that's real healthy for me growing as a person. Let me now make the comments on making amends. Early in the program, before the ninth step, I and a lot of other people make what I call the important brown nose amends. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, we've got to make them. I had to make some amends to the parish. I had to make some amends to my pastor. I had to make some amends to the bishop. But they're done in a very, very different spirit than the amends I'm making now. You know, the way I act before the eighth step, before the fourth step, is very different from the way I'm going to act when I've reached the ninth step of the program. I'm not criticizing people doing that. The most asinine comment I heard in that sense was, we had a guy where I sobered up when he came to AA, had 30-some hot checks out. And he started going around picking them up. And somebody said, you're not supposed to do that till you reach the ninth step. If he waited to that time, he'd have been in the penitentiary. You know, that's silly. There's some practical things. You have to get your boss off your back. You have to make peace in your family. But somehow I think there's a slightly different spirit when we really reach the step itself. I think there's a statement in the big book that we ought to notice, and we've got to notice when we make amends. It's the single most shocking statement in the big book. And it's in the section of making amends, and it says that when we go to make our amends, and I'm paraphrasing, and I don't like to do that, we never crawl. It says that as God's children, we stand. I'm not ready to make honest amends to you, amends in the spirit of the ninth step, if I'm crawling, if I'm abasing myself, if I'm humiliating myself. And that's very important. This is not a groveling step. This is a step of health. I have been brought up and made a miracle, And I'm not going to debase myself when I walk into your life and say I was wrong doing something. I'm going to stay standing. And you may not think I belong there. You may not want me to be standing. But for the health of my program, with God's strength, I'm not going to allow you to put me down on my knees either. I'm going to remain standing when I walk up to you to heal the relationship. As God's children, we stand. And until I can stand in my own heart, that's why it becomes so important in the healing relationship for me to be an adult healthy person relating with an adult healthy person. Because if I'm still sick and I'm groveling to you, that's not a healthy, healed relationship. The phrase we have in the world is kissing ass. And the ninth step is not kissing ass at all. The ninth step is one of the most, I would say, Christian, personal, healthy things you can find in the world. It's one human being reaching out the hand of a love, of a hand in love to remove every obstacle in the relationship to another human being. I keep my dignity, and I set the matter aright. When I go to make my amends, I better not and cannot write the script in advance, and that's what I usually want to do. I want to write out the whole thing. The first time I saw this was when it ends. I had the whole scene worked out, rang the doorbell, started my scene. The guy answered the doorbell, and he started changing the script. And I kept trying to bring him back into the script that I wrote. And it was a horrible thing. I kept trying to bring it back to the way I wrote it, the way it was supposed to turn out. And he was just so free and loose and enjoying the whole thing. I don't mean in a sick way, in a healthy way, enjoying me and what I was doing. And he didn't understand I had this script we had to conform to. I don't try to do that anymore. If I'm ready now to go make amends to you, what I try to do when I'm going to see you is just let God love me. I meditate. Because I now realize that if I'm filled with love and I come into your presence, whatever I say is going to be flow from love, and it's what God wants. I've had to make some amends to some of my archbishops, both of them, the last two. The present one, it kept occurring to me I was going to walk up and say, I'm sorry for all the things I told you. I questioned his ancestry. Used a lot of other Anglo-Saxon words. I used every word but one. And that's because a bishop wouldn't know a good screw if he had one in my book. So I didn't see any sense in wasting the word. You may understand why they don't give me good assignments. But I didn't use that word. Anyway, I was praying and the bishop popped up, and what came out is, I'm sorry for some of the things I said. And I felt how honestly God had that come out. Because some of the things I told him in tough love, he needed to hear. For the good of the church and for his own good. And they weren't wrong. And I should not retract those. And it came out just so ideally. Bob White told me, the guy who's helped me split the eighth step, never make a step of this program harder than it is. I went to see him on the amends. Told him about all the money I stole. And I was going to go up and stand in front of the whole parish and tell him all about it. And he said, who has the ultimate responsibility for that money? I said, the pastor and the archbishop. He said, those are the only two people you tell. This is not a whipping step, nor is any part of the program a whipping part of the program. You just want to set matters aright. You go see both of them, and you start seeing what you can do to set the matters aright. This is important because after he said this, he added something else onto it. He said, therefore, you only make amends once. I'd have gone back groveling to people in an unhealthy way again and again and again. I don't do that. If I come to you to make my amends, whether you've accepted them or not, I make them only once. And I never make the step harder than it is. He's helped me in setting up my fifth step for people. Somebody comes to do a fifth step for me, I've got a whole room set up for it. And it is all planned well. Everything is set up before they arrive, except for coffee. I never drink coffee, so I don't want to waste a pot. And if people arrive and they drink coffee, they've got like 5 minutes of panic until the first pot is brewed. But I've got two easy chairs that face each other on a proper angle. The light is very kind of subdued, so nobody is staring into bright light. There's gentle, soft music playing from speakers. There's a little stand right beside them that has an ashtray and a box of tissues, so that if they break up crying, I don't stop them. I used to never be able to watch people cry because I felt this guilt. Right now, you can have a nervous breakdown in my home, and I'm just going to sit there and encourage you to have it, because I know that the expression of feelings is so healthy. And if you're sobbing, that's good. And that's a very good thing. It's just all so set up. You know, a lot of us feel we ought to do our fifth step kneeling on ashes and whipping ourselves, and that's not it. The hardness of the step is just in the saying. And often in the fifth step, somebody will tell me something, and it wasn't painful enough. So they go back over it a second time, and I'll stop them. And I'm saying, you know what you're trying to do? You're trying to whip yourself. It didn't sound bad enough. You don't make this step hard enough. You've told me that's all. We go on to something else. That's all there is to it. You know, amends involves more than words. I co-signed a note for somebody and got stuck for two payments. Called her up and chewed her out. And she started crying. I said, don't give me this crying stuff. I'm not chewing you out because you couldn't make the payments. That could happen to anybody. I'm chewing you out because you didn't have the courtesy to call me. And I can't come up with this kind of money on my cash on a moment's notice. She made the next payment, missed the next three, and I had to close out the note. And I ran into her right after that at an AA conference. She came running up saying, oh, I want to make amends to you. I'm so sorry that I stuck you for the note. And I looked at her and I said, I won't accept your amends. I went to talk to somebody and found out I don't have a right to do that, and went back to her and I said, I was wrong in not accepting your amends, but I want you to know right now I can't afford the luxury of your friendship. That was 10 years ago. I've never seen a cent of money since. I don't think she made any amends at all. She just said some words. If she had healed her relationship and been sincere, it would have been followed by cash. As my sponsor said once in my book, he really helped me with this. He said, it isn't the principle, it's the money that counts. And that helped me be so human. You know, it's good to know. I was trying to put it on a high level. I don't have to be. I got hurt because she stung me for money. And that was where I really meant it. My sponsor told me something from the 10th step, the last year and a half, that has really changed a lot of the 9th step making amends. It's so good. The 10th step says, when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Admit it we were wrong. Do you know that I've gone to people and told them I was sorry and I wasn't really sorry and there was a strain inside me? I wasn't really sorry for what I did, but it was wrong. And since he said this, if I'm sorry for what I did, I could tell you that. But he once sent me to make amends to the secretary of an AA club that I was at war with and had bad-mouthed very much, and this helped very much. I could go up to her and tell her I was wrong saying it, because in my heart, I wasn't sorry I said it. But it was wrong. It wasn't good for her, and it wasn't good for AA, and it wasn't good for me, so it was wrong saying it. And that takes so much of the strain off that. Incidentally, I have an aside on this. After he sent me to her, a month later, I had this big fight with this horrible nun, not the one that fired me, another one. They had a bumper crop of horrible nuns in this place. The place bristled with bitches, if you know what I mean. And I was their chaplain. Anyway, I start ready to go to my sponsor over the fight, and I figure, hell no, he's going to send me to make amends to her, and that's the last damn thing I'm going to do. So I decided to go to a priest, a very good priest friend of mine, to confession instead. And I went to confession, and he gave me as a penance, go and make an amends to her. Now, you laugh. I'm going to tell you, I'd been going to this priest for 5 years to confession, and he never, ever said anything like that. And I could just hear God laugh. Ha ha, you try to pull an end run on me, you little Pollock. I'll fix you. Injure others has nothing to do with injuring myself. It's just injuring other people. You know, often we don't consider other people. We walk up to somebody and we'll say, I got to tell you something. And this is, I think, an offshoot sometimes of treatment, where treatment tries to make people aware of their feelings and state their feelings. But that doesn't necessarily carry over in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't think you necessarily have a right to tell me you resent me, because that can injure me. I don't get a big kick out of somebody walking up and saying, I hate your guts. And I don't think that's being sensitive to the feelings of other people. Not necessarily. Nor is it necessarily healthy to dump my sexual guilt on somebody who will be hurt by it. I think, therefore, it is best to discuss all amends with a sponsor. I haven't done this with my remaining list yet. I need to. But I've had 3 or 4 people I sponsor come to me with their list. And I've pared it down by a quarter, because I've got a better insight than they do. And some of these people had shared enough that there were names on there that I knew that should have been on there. And I told them, you know, you told me how you hurt your wife. Her name isn't on there. I think you owe her amends. Yeah, I think you ought to make those. So much for the first part. Now, what I'm going to share is possibly one of the most important parts of anything that I've said from the effects. It's amends to the dead. Chuck C. according to somebody else, once said, you can't make amends to the dead because they are dead. I don't know if you've ever heard anybody say that, but I really don't agree with that at all. I can't. Other people feel that you can substitute for the dead, making amends to the living. That's nice. I can do that if I've stolen from somebody dead. But I think amends can be made directly to the dead in three particular ways. I sponsor someone, an attorney, who was over 4 years sober, who had the deepest spiritual experience he ever had in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous at the grave of his mother after I told him what he should go and do. And it changed his relationship with his mother. She had died a drinking alcoholic, and he went to the grave, and he got his anger out, and he forgave her, and then he asked for forgiveness. And it changed his continuing relationship with his wife from that day on. I'm going to share with you in a moment my own experience and the experience of some women, and you're going to see that these have been powerful experiences. There's three basic ways that I'm aware of that you can make amends to the dead, and I would suggest you don't pick the easiest. The easiest, softer way is never the healthiest. Pick the one that fits your personality the best. One is you write a letter to the dead person, and after it's written, you can burn it. Biblically, burning something is a way of offering something to God, and I believe the dead are alive and they're with God, and this is a way then to offer the letter to them. The second way, and the way I use the most often, is to use imagination in prayer. I picture me, the dead person, and the Lord. And in these, I'm always just a spiteful little child because I'm so angry. And I'm stomping my feet and I'm spitting out the anger. And the last way, and the most impressive, is to visit the grave. Sometimes that's not geographically easy. This needs some preparation. Basically, what I've got to do is first, whether it's in the letter or the prayer, in the imagination or at the grave, I've got to get out all of my anger at the hurt that has been done me. I don't first start making the amends. See, when there's anger in me, there can't be peace. I can't be ready to tell you that I want forgiveness until I get the anger, the hate I have for you, out of my system. I'll say it now because I didn't write it here. It comes up indirectly in a moment. For about most of the time when someone has died, our strongest hate is we hate them for dying. And that's a very deep buried hate. Therefore, our most important forgiveness is to give them permission to be dead. And that should be the very last thing that is done, if it's to be done in the right order, with real help. What I do first, whether it's in the letter or the imagination, and I've got it all ready with the list, or at the grave, I express my anger. If you're doing it at the grave, do it aloud. Of course, be sure nobody's there, because this can be a very heavy scene. You're going to scream, and you're going to shout, and you're going to cry maybe sometimes, depending upon how emotional you can be. I express all my anger, and I do it in exactly the words I feel, and I tell them, what a damn, you know, how damn selfish they were treating me like this and the pain that I've had. And then I forgive them. Then I mention all the harm that I've done. And I ask for forgiveness. And then I give permission for them to be dead. Let me tell you some specific instances that I've had. When I taught in the high school, after I made friends with a lot of the high school students after they graduated, one graduated, and he came over that summer to my home, told me once about how he got drunk, and he came back for a football game. He and I were very close friends. We were together two or three times a day. He really respected me. And he had been drinking, and he brought his vodka in, and it didn't look like he had been drinking much. I'm going to use that as an excuse, and I shouldn't even say that. I should take it exactly as it occurs. And I allowed him to go on drinking in my home. That night, from my home, he went to the football game. It was on the same grounds, had a fight with his girlfriend, got in his car, and the next thing we knew, he was driving down the extreme left lane of a four-lane, two-way street and caused a head-on collision with several cars, badly damaging several people and killing himself. I went down to the hospital to identify the body so the family wouldn't have to. And I've known enough already from Fifth Steps driving down, I wanted to kill him. And I knew I wanted to kill him because I loved him, not because of what he did to me and how he had harmed himself. And very fortunately, of course, you can imagine the ton of guilt I felt 9 years in AA, somebody drinking at my home and getting killed. Fortunately, there was a treatment center in that Catholic hospital. And I went from the body and the family up to the treatment center where there were some tremendous counselors. And the very first thing the one that I dealt with did was have me talk it all out. And then she wouldn't allow me to leave when I did that. She had me write it all out. And her real wisdom was then she had me talk it all out again. The talking was to prepare me. The writing was the fourth step, and the fifth step followed. She didn't have me do step five and then four. I talked, I wrote, and I shared. But that got rid of my guilt, but I still had a broken relationship with him. And I had to go into prayer, and I had to get rid of all my anger at him for dying. And then I had to get rid of my guilt and ask for my forgiveness. And that relationship was healed, and it's been healed to this day. I sponsored somebody, a drug addict. I've shared a little bit about him. The person who I sponsored who had no good self-esteem, and he came in, and he found a self-esteem, and he found God, and he started going to church. And I warned him at that point. I'd been sponsoring him like about a year and a half, and I told him when he cut away from the program that he wasn't going to last. That was our experience, and church couldn't keep him sober. And he didn't listen, and he broke completely from AA, and he went to church. And I thought he'd last 2 to 3 years. He lasted 8 months. And he came back. And he's one of these strange people who could never get back on the program. And he wrote me 2 letters. And in the letters, he hinted that he wanted me to sponsor him again. But yeah, I find it very difficult to forgive people who have broken from me. And so I wanted him to ask outright. And before he asked outright, he killed himself. And I felt some guilt and some anger at him for that. And I worked it through an imaginative prayer. And that part I shared in AA talks for quite a while. I never shared the last part. There still was something missing. I never gave him permission to die. And about a half year ago, I went back into prayer. Because, see, I felt guilt for the suicide, not just anger. And I gave him permission to be dead. And that released me of my guilt. And I haven't had it to this day. 2 years ago, after I became aware of all this, I was going back on vacation to Pennsylvania. And my dad died, and I stood at his grave, and I felt absolutely nothing. This was not this trip. This was when I was 21 years old, before drinking became a serious problem in my life. But I was so filled with hurt, I stood at my dad's grave and felt a little bit of guilt for feeling absolutely nothing. 10 years sober in the program, I sat at the grave. And made peace with my dad. And he's never left me since. And I carry his love. And this works. I have a loving father. When I grew up, I could never feel my father's love. I feared him. He tried to love me. He gave himself in love for me. He killed himself in love for me. But I couldn't feel that love. I have never really been without my dad's presence. He's with me. Because he's with a God of love, and that God is with me. But that's just words. I feel the personal presence of my Father. And this works in very, very powerful ways. And because of these experiences and many others, and I'm still getting into the heaviest area, it becomes very important for me to tell you that you lose something if you just make amends to the living or feel that because they're dead you can't do something. What I want to go into now is an area that I can't share on at all. And I'm sharing on it only because of what some tremendous women shared with me. I'm going to share on amends if there's been abortions, whether they're spontaneous or deliberate in your own life. And this is so strange, I'm going to tell you how it comes into me. I had women do fifth steps, and I would maybe just make a suggestion. And they came back and they started telling me things. Now, the first thing they told me is, that they knew the sex of every child they aborted. Some of them would have 2, 3, 4 abortions. I could guess that somebody would figure that out, and that could just be a mental game. But enough women, not knowing each other, told me the second thing, that my life has been turned around in my attitude toward this. They told me they knew the name that fit every single child that they aborted. And that flabbergasted me. The name sometimes just comes instantly. Other times they'll go in quiet, and after about 3 or 4 names, after 3 or 4 minutes, a name fits, and they just know that's their child's name. And that tells me that you know, these fetuses were real living persons, and they still have their unique identity with God. And I've told them how to go make amends. Because, you see, if there is a child, now, I hate sharing on this for one reason, and that's because I'm a Catholic priest. And most of you know the Catholic Church's attitude on that. And this has nothing to do with this at all. I wish I weren't a priest just to share with you this one area. because the effects here have been so dramatic. So absolutely stunning in a lot of women's lives, including very recently in the life of someone that's rather close to me, and I can't put it any more general, any more specific, because I no way would I ever want to harm the anonymity. As I told you, almost always when I talk about people, I change some facts. If possible, I'll change sex, change years, change places, so that you, I don't feel I'm in any way divulging anything in confidence, but I'm sharing what I've been given to me. Anyway, the person goes, you go and you sit down in quiet, and you start praying in imagination. You picture your child, and you know, your child's with God. Your child's perfectly happy. But there's one thing missing for perfect happiness in your child's life. And incidentally, this applies to guys also. And I've had some guys who have had powerful experiences with this. Your baby cannot be perfectly happy with a God of love until it is able to fully love his or her mother and get love back from his or her mother. That's the one thing lacking. If you're with God, and God is love, I don't think you break your relationships to this earth. I don't want that to happen. I don't think, I know my father doesn't love me any less. He loves me perfectly now. And he wants me to be able to feel this love in a very perfect and a real way. And so your child, being with God, wants your love to be complete and wants to be able to love you. And all you do, if you abort it deliberately, just say you're sorry. Heck, it's no big thing with your child. Your child started an eternity of happiness all the more. But it'll be good for you to say it. I'm sorry I did it. But then really say, whether it was spontaneous or deliberate, say the thing that's important. I'm sorry that I've ignored you for so long. And I want to be loved by you, and I want to love you. And do it individually for each of the children. Now, I will guarantee that there's maybe 30 or 40 women here whose lives can be changed because they've done that. Where you know you need to do this is if you've mentioned an abortion in your fourth and fifth step and there's something still weighing on you. The fourth and fifth steps, I believe, really take away guilt. What is lacking is, I believe, your child's just calling for your love. I can just share that, not of my own experience at all, but from the experience of other people. The final area that I'd like to share on, very quickly, because there's just a few minutes left, is making amends to yourself. You know, most people in the eighth step put themselves or lend many people at the top of the list, but you almost never hear anybody talk about when they reach the ninth step what they do to make amends to themselves. And a lot of people say they just make living amends by working the program. Well, you know, I don't think just making living amends to people in my family that I hurt was enough. I had to do something special. And I have hurt myself so much by hating myself and disliking myself and putting myself down that I have got to make living amends to me. Have you ever bought yourself a Christmas present? You know, just go buy yourself a shirt or a blouse because you're special. And you want you to know that you're special regardless of how you felt about yourself. It's a real healthy thing to do. Have you ever done a favor for yourself? I went, where this started being open in my life, I went to a priest who later came into the program to confession when we started Lent, and he gave me a penance. And he started saying, I want you to do a favor, and I knew what he was going to say for somebody every day during Lent. But that wasn't what he said. He said, I want you to do a favor for yourself every day during Lent. Eat a candy bar. Listen to your favorite record. Pause a moment to watch a sunset or a sunrise. Do something just for you. Do you know it was impossible for me to keep that penance for all 40 days of Lent? And for those of us who have the Al-Anon personality who feel guilt for being, we'll never be able to do 40 days in a row of favors for ourselves, but the effort of doing some nice things for ourselves. If you'd give a rose and want a rose, you know, give a rose to your wife, give a rose to yourself sometime. Just give yourself the symbol, whatever would be a rose for you. Go out and buy an album just for yourself. Learn to play. I want to take a moment. You know, I feel embarrassed at anything that is good for me. I've got a ring, and if you come up and notice it, please notice my ring. It was a present for being 10 years sober, and it's a 10-point diamond. And again, if you want to know that I'm sick, the person who gave it to me said you get a 15-point diamond on your 15th birthday. Instantly, the instant thought that came to me is I cannot wait to my 50th birthday. That's just what happened. Anyway, I was talking at a conference where, thank God, my sponsor was, and I excused away the ring. And he landed on my butt so hard when I was finished, it was just tremendous. He said, I never want to hear you apologize again in your life for making yourself look good. How can a miracle not want to dress itself up? Why should I excuse what I do to make the miracle of my being on top of the water attractive to you? I now have a wardrobe. Anytime I'm invited to speak from the podium, I do what my sponsor says, and I try to make myself look as good as I can because it's making me look good in my own eyes. 9 years sober, I started learning to play. I forced myself to go canoeing. I started learning to ski and to take the time off. And I felt guilt when I did it originally. This year, I skied California, Pennsylvania, and Colorado in the month of January. I had 3 other ski vacations, and let me tell you, when I went skiing, I didn't think of anybody that I sponsor or anybody in AA, unless they had a deep problem. I just went and I enjoyed myself. I have learned to make amends to myself. I consider that a happy and a healthy part of AA. Thank you very, very much.